We have last Sunday and this Sunday been looking at a series of talks on the history of kings in the nation of Israel. And for those who haven't been to the early meetings, let me briefly say what I've been trying to say, or outline what I've been trying to say. Basically, Israel, at two points in their history, made choices. They said, in the days of Samuel, who was their leader, we want a king. Samuel, as prophet who was in touch with God, said, this is not good, this is not what God wants. The people have said, nonetheless, we want a king. God gave them a king, but kings led them into captivity. Kings did not help the nation of Israel at all. 1,000 years after they made that mistake, they were offered another king. It was at a trial. The trial was of Jesus himself, and it was a Roman governor who said to the people, here is your king. This time, faced with a choice, they said no. Ironically, they ought to have said no in the days of Samuel and yes in the days of Pilate. But in both cases, they made the wrong choice. And it's interesting to look at Israel's history in the light of those two choices. Now, this morning we had a look at three good kings: David, Hezekiah, and Josiah. And we looked at the histories of these people and of the great things they did for the nation, but pointed out in each of them there was a fatal flaw, and that this flaw is probed, and that this flaw is explained and left in the story in order that we might see that all of their kings, the lot of them, 40 of them, over a period of 5 centuries, were all failures. But tonight I want to talk about the three bad guys. It was very easy to pick three bad ones, actually. There was a great choice. Very hard to find three good ones. In fact, there are probably only three. But very easy to pick three bad kings. And I again want to illustrate the opposite side of the coin. You know, what kings really did, to show you how disastrous it was. Now, I want to begin by reading a couple of verses in the first book of Kings, chapter 2. Now, this is where you begin to read the story of King Solomon. And it says in verse 45 of 1 Kings chapter 2, but King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. Then the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and he struck him down and he died. And so the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. Now, Solomon became king only after a whole lot of intrigue, after murder, after the assassination of people who might have been contenders for the throne, and finally, as it were, when all other contenders were out of the way, only Solomon was left, and the kingdom became his. But it wasn't a very satisfactory way, really, to become king. And then it says in chapter 3, verse 1, now it has said, so Solomon became king. Watch this next verse, because it's very important. What's the first thing we're told about Solomon? And Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. He took and married Pharaoh's daughter. For most of us, Solomon is a hero. Solomon is the man who wrote Proverbs, at least many of the Proverbs that we've got. Over 300, and the best part maybe of 400, of Solomon's Proverbs are recorded for us in the book of Proverbs. Solomon also built the temple, one of the really great buildings of pre-Christian times. Solomon was also a man noted for his wisdom. And Solomon gave to the nation of Israel 40 years of peace. Did you know that there were no battles fought in the days of Solomon? Israel did not have to get her army out at all. David had secured for the nation peace, and Solomon ensured that they had it. But Solomon gave to the country peace in a very bad way. Solomon gave the country peace by marrying. Did you know that Solomon had, was it 700 wives and 300 concubines? Why did he have all these wives? Couldn't look after them all. Cost him a lot to support them. But he did that in order that he might have peace. The nation might have peace, I'm sure he didn't have it. Five times in the story, the Bible writer said, Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. And for the person who put this together, the historian, and for God who inspired that historian to write the history in this way, you have something that's awfully important. We think of Solomon as the temple builder. We think of Solomon as the man who gave us Proverbs. We think of Solomon as a man who had wisdom, and he had all of those things and did all those great things. But nevertheless, Solomon has been aptly described as the wisest fool who ever lived. Solomon, in the long run, did nothing for Israel. He led them astray. He taught Israel to live the way of the nations. He did exactly what other kings did. If you didn't want Pharaoh to fight you, you made him as a father-in-law. And that's exactly what Solomon did. He spent much of his reign planning these marriages and guaranteeing his peace. But in order to support all this, he had to tax the people. Much worse than Malcolm Fraser. Much worse than any government we know. He had to tax the people. And when the people could not pay, he just took them and made them as slaves. Upon his death, the nation revolted, and the kingdom was divided and remained as two kingdoms for the next three centuries before one of those kingdoms was destroyed forever. That was Solomon's legacy. Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, did not use that wisdom that God gave him for good ends. He began well. He ended up really an old fool. That was one of the consequences of the monarchy. That was something that the Israelite asked on himself when he said to Samuel, "Give us a king." And Samuel said, "You're mad. God will help you if other kings attack you, but he will not help you if you are oppressed by one of your own people." And oppressed they were. Well, history went on. And two centuries later, another king was born. His name was Ahaz. And you read best about this man in Isaiah chapter 7. In Isaiah chapter 7, you have the story of Isaiah the prophet going to this king. Now Ahaz, as I said, was one of the really bad kings. Ahaz was surrounded by a lot of nations, all of whom wanted him destroyed. To the north was Israel, the larger part of the people of God. Nobody there liked him. To the northwest was Syria. And Syria, or Syrians and Judahites, were enemies a long time before Jesus was born. And then there was a much bigger nation of Assyria, which was flexing its muscles, and in fact, within three decades, would be masters of all the world. And Ahaz was just a small king, looking after a very small kingdom with very little to protect himself. And all he could do was to see nations round about him and to be frightened. He wasn't big enough to fight. He wasn't brave enough to fight. All he could do was to be frightened. And God's prophet Isaiah went to this king and said, "Don't be frightened. Don't be worried about those nations and armies which are so much bigger than you, for God is on your side." And Ahaz looked at Isaiah and said, "I know nothing about your God. I can't see him. He doesn't come here to fight. Give me armies. Give me chariots. Give me people. Give me money. And then I'll feel safe." And Isaiah looked at this king and said, "Listen, I know you don't believe. But if you ask God anything, anything at all, He'll do it for you. Now, I don't think there is a greater offer in all of the Bible, maybe in all of history, than that offer Isaiah made to the king. Now, just imagine what would happen if I said to you, you can have anything you want. And God will do it, just to show He's really there. The mind boggles, doesn't it? The mind really boggles. Ahaz could have asked for anything, and God would have given it to him. But Ahaz was a genuine atheist. He didn't believe in God, didn't want God, and didn't even put God to the test. I think that shattered Isaiah. Isaiah, I think, might have even been frightened as he said to Ahaz, ask anything you want, because he had no idea what this heathen man would ask. But when the man says, I won't even test God, I won't ask God for a thing, Isaiah went back to headquarters and virtually said, God, what do I do now? And God said to Isaiah, go back and tell him that although he did not believe, although he did not ask a sign, here was a sign. And God said to him, but the sign will be this, that a child will be born within the palace, and before this child is old enough to know right and wrong, those kingdoms which he fears would be destroyed forever. God offered a sign. The king said, I don't want it. God said, you'll have one nonetheless. And that sign has remained with us. The sign was fulfilled. For within a very short time, both the northern kingdom of Assyria, or rather the kingdom of Israel, and the small kingdom of Assyria was destroyed by the Assyrians. Nothing was left. And Judah remained at peace. There is Israel's king. The people said, we want a king. But this king no longer even believes in God. What kind of a people can that person create? The last Jewish king is found in, or the story of, is found in the Book of Kings, or Second Book of Kings, chapter 24. There were some awful things happened at the end of Israel's history. For instance, the king of Jerusalem, or the king who lived in Jerusalem, revolted against the Babylonians. And the Babylonians finally came, and the people in the city knew that things were going to be bad. The Babylonians, when they came in the 6th century, really meant business. The Jews had pestered them, had antagonized them, had annoyed them for decades. And when Nebuchadnezzar came in 596, he meant business. And the Jews looked at their king, who had revolted, who had annoyed the king of Babylon, and they killed him. They assassinated him, and they put his son on the throne. Well, Nebuchadnezzar came, regardless of what the people had done. But probably the slaughter was nothing like as much, because the people had killed their king. But a young 18-year-old who was made king was taken away to live in Babylon, and he stayed there for the best part of 40 years. He never returned home. But then the Babylonians did something that must have really hurt Jewish pride. And they found somebody else, and they said, this man shall be your king. And they took a man called Zedekiah. Zedekiah was the uncle of the young boy who they'd taken away. And they put him on the throne. And they said to this man, you will do what we tell you. Now, Nobody likes a puppet king. That's all Israel's last king was. The history of all this began though centuries before, when the people said, "We want a king. We want a king who will fight our battles. We want a king who will represent us." What kind of a king did they have at the end of their history? Not one whom they chose, but one who was forced on them by the king of an outside nation. Zedekiah tried for 10 years to live with that tension. He knew the boss over there was the king of Babylon. He knew he was king because of his choice. He also knew that nobody in the nation liked him. He also knew that everybody in the nation wanted to revolt. But the nation wasn't strong enough, nor did anybody with any spiritual perception advise him so to do. But nonetheless, Zedekiah was not a wise man, nor was he a good king. And in spite of being told by prophets not to revolt, he revolted. Maybe he'd thought about the times when God had helped the people earlier, and God had certainly done that in their history. In the story of Moses, the story of Samson, the story of Gideon, the story of so many heroes in the past, God had really come down and helped Israel when Israel could not help herself. Maybe Zedekiah thought God would do that again. But the prophets had told Zedekiah that God would not. But then Zedekiah didn't believe the prophets. He only hoped. He revolted, and the Babylonians came. But there was no hail from heaven, no rain to bog down their chariots, no plague to chase away their armies, nothing at all. Just stillness, the stench of smoke, and the smell of death. And as it got closer and closer to Jerusalem, and as all the outposts fell, Zedekiah realized it was the end. What would Israel's king do? Now, this was the man who ought to be leading the Jews to be the ruler of the world. What would their king do? The king whom they wanted? The king blackened his face. He put charcoal all over it. He put on some old tatty clothes so he looked like a commoner. He dug a hole in the city wall. And at night, he ran away. And that was in days when a king was expected to stand up and fight for his people. The man was a coward. The man was not worthy to be king at all. And the historian tells us that no matter what he did, in spite of his disguise, in spite of blackening himself, in spite of doing all of this at night, Nebuchadnezzar caught him. This was the man whom Nebuchadnezzar had made to be king, and who wasn't even doing Nebuchadnezzar's job. And he called for all his children to be brought before him, all of that man's children. And while that man was watching, while that king was watching, Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers slaughtered all his family. But it was the last thing the father would see. For Nebuchadnezzar then gave instruction that that king Zedekiah, that his eyes be burned out. Not killed. He wasn't killed. Just his eyes burned out. And he was then taken off as a prize of war to Babylon. Ghastly, isn't it? It is ghastly. And yet the historian writes it not again to be sensational, not in order to get our adrenaline pumping as we read this story, but to say something that he thought to be very important. You see, where is Israel's last king? The last king is blind and in captivity in a foreign country. That is where kings led the nation. You see, Samuel had warned the people that if their king led them into trouble, God would not deliver them. If they had no king and looked to God, he would. But once they wanted a king, once they wanted their own leader, and if that leader led them into trouble, he would not help them at all. The people, when they heard that, said, "It won't happen." But it did. And it was only in Zedekiah's day, 5 centuries later, that the people realized exactly what that meant. Instead of kingship leading them into light and liberty, into peace and prosperity, it led them into darkness and death. Nonetheless, even out of all of that, God still intended to bring them back. And it is interesting to read the stories of those people a second time and to listen to what prophets said as all of this was happening. As they had terrible kings, as they had in the Clint Eastwood movie, the good, the bad and the ugly. Well, mainly the bad and the ugly. As they had those things, God suddenly against this background of awfulness and wickedness and ugliness, he paints the picture of the kind of king he would like. And it was in the days of Ahaz, perhaps Israel's or Judah's worst king, that the prophet said to the people, not to Ahaz, but to the people, "One day, God will give you a king who is a wonderful counselor, a mighty God, an everlasting Father, and a Prince of Peace." That, of course, is Isaiah 9, verse 6. And you best understand that verse against the background of this man, Ahaz. You see, what kind of a counselor was Ahaz? What kind of advice did he give the nation? Did it help them? Not one little bit. But God said this final king, not like Ahaz, who was a most unworthy counselor, he will be a wonderful counselor, a man whose counsel is wonderful. He won't be, as the nation looked upon their king, as some kind of god who was weak, but the one who would come would be, in terms of kingship, a king or a god who was mighty. And the word God there is used essentially in the olden idea of the king being God. The Egyptians looked upon their kings as God. The Babylonians worshipped their kings as God. And in a sense, maybe at times even Israel looked upon their king as God in the sense that he had to save them. And if he couldn't, they had no hope. This later king would not be a God king like Ahab, or Ahaz rather, but would be one who was mighty. He wouldn't, like Ahaz, be a father who would die. I think many people in Israel might have been pleased that he did. But this last king would be a father who lived forever. No need to replace him. And some of us, and some of you have got fathers who you want to hold on to forever. This is the kind of person this new king would be. But last of all, he would be a prince of peace. Ahaz didn't bring to the nation peace. He was surrounded by war. And he wanted to fight the nations on their terms and was frightened because of it. And so were all in Israel. But Isaiah said the king who is to come would not bring war. He would cause wars to finish. And he will be known for bringing peace. They must have looked at Ahaz and wondered and dreamed. Ironically enough, of course, when the king came, they didn't even recognize him, for he was just so different from all the kings that they had known. But the other reference I want to make in concluding this talk is to something that Ezekiel said. Ezekiel was another prophet who lived in the days of Zedekiah, that last king. In fact, even before Zedekiah ran away from Jerusalem, even before he tried to deceive the people and the Babylonians in that escape attempt, Ezekiel had told the people in Babylon where he was that that's exactly what's going to happen. And it's very fascinating to read the history of it in Kings and the prophetic statement, the announcement beforehand of it in the book of Ezekiel. But it was Ezekiel who, after all this had happened, after Zedekiah had run away and was captured, he says this: prophesy and say to people, ho, kings of Israel, you have fed yourselves. Shouldn't you have looked after the people? You have ate the best things. You've clothed yourselves with the wool. You've slaughtered the very best of the sheep for yourselves. But you didn't look after the people at all. The weak you didn't strengthen. The sick you have not healed. The crippled you have not bound. The strayed you have not brought back. The lost you have not sought. And so my people were scattered because there was no shepherd. But the word shepherd means king. And Ezekiel is saying in these words, after Zedekiah's eyes have been put out, he's saying the kings of Israel, who ought to have been shepherds and ought to have looked after the sheep, have only looked after themselves. They've built their palaces. They have made themselves and their families rich. They haven't cared for the people. And so all of the people, the whole nation, was scattered because there was nobody to look after them. And then he says in verse 11 of this chapter 34, for thus says God, behold, I myself will seek out my sheep. I'll search for them, as a shepherd seeks out her flock when some of his sheep have been scattered abroad, so will I seek out my sheep. I will rescue them from all places. And I will be the shepherd of my sheep, and I will make them to lie down. And I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind the crippled, and I will strengthen the weak, and the fat and the strong I will destroy. I will feed them in justice. Jesus knew those words. And when he came, he took those words and he spoke them to the people. Ezekiel knew worthless kings, worthless shepherds, and spoke of an ideal shepherd who was to come. And Jesus took up Ezekiel 34 and he said to the people, here I am. Ezekiel had said, I would send a good shepherd. I am the good shepherd who gives my life for the sheep. And they looked at him, and he again looked so different. He didn't look like any king that they had. And tragically for them, they said, no, he's not king. But he was. He was that king of whom Isaiah spoke. He was the shepherd of whom Ezekiel spoke. And he is God's king. And tonight, as we come to the end of these talks, as we come to the end of this service tonight, I want to tell you authoritatively that Jesus is God's king. And that Jesus came into this world, and people took him and did with him as they pleased. That allowed God to show the kind of people Israel were. The kind of people we were. For God is trying to say in that event that when goodness comes, evil will destroy it. For evil feels threatened by goodness. But God does not allow even that to destroy his purposes. In fact, ironically, it's part of his purposes. For the one who is shepherd dies, not for himself, for he remains shepherd. But in order that the sheep might be saved, he said, the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. They didn't understand it, but we do now. And we look at that event in terms of the king who came and who didn't run away. The king who believed God. The king who, when the enemy came, did not blacken his face and disguise himself and run away, as Israel's last king did, but who stood firm. He called upon no army. He trusted God. And God, in his own purposes, allowed him to be killed, knowing that because he was the good king, he would rise from the dead. And he lives forevermore. And he is king. And he's looking for sheep. He's looking for people to be part of the kingdom that he is creating. And all of us here tonight are either part of that kingdom or not. There's no limbo, no space in between these kingdoms. We are either part of God's kingdom. We are those over whom Jesus Christ rules and reigns. Or we are not. And I leave with you this awful challenge. I wish it were some other way. It's not. You either belong to this king or you don't. If you belong to this king, you're on the winning side. For he brings peace. In the end, he will bring prosperity, but now he brings peace and calm amongst all kinds of turmoil. He brings forgiveness of sin and purity and new direction and a whole new hope. He brings all these things. He brings them amidst a whole lot of things that still strike us as people who live in this world. The cyclone comes and it hits the Christian as much as it hits the non-Christian. The flood may come and it will destroy things that belong to Christians and non-Christians. But in that, he gives to his sheep peace. The person who is wise, the person who really thinks, ought to make the right decision that this one is worth trusting. May God really help you to make that decision. And if you've made the wrong one, may he speak to you and bring you into his kingdom.